This is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th age. I'm your host JM, and with me as always are Nick and Mark.
Hey. Hello.
We have a great show for you this week. We are trying a new format out, and today, in one unique thing, we're going to be looking at alternative uses for icon relationship roles. Well, let's head into one unique thing.
One unique thing.
Welcome to One Unique Thing. Mark, you want to give us a brief overview for those of our new listeners who might not really know how icon relationships work?
You pick, when you create in your character, what kind of relationship out of all the different icons, if you want to have a relationship with them. And it can be a positive, ambiguous, or a negative relationship with them.
Okay.
And there's different ways you can use that, and that's, I think, what we're going to talk about is kind of, why would I pick a negative relationship? Well, part of it is it's story-driven.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you got to have some of that conflict. And there's different kinds of icons, as we know. So you pick what icons you want to have a relationship with, and then you assign your dice, and you start with three, and they go up at different levels, and you add a couple more. And certain classes get different things they can twist and add some dice. But you roll a D6, typically at the beginning of a session, and that's the thing we'll talk about, too, is other uses, is other times you can roll. You roll it, and in a 5 or a 6, something good can happen. In a 5, something good can happen, but it's going to have consequences.
Okay.
And a 6, it's something good is going to happen. Yay, me as a player.
That's right.
And that's how the rules lay out those for the session. And there's different ways you can use it. They have suggestions, and from some of our feedback from listeners, they want more on how to use these.
Yeah.
Well, on page 179 of the rule book, the authors even note that the way they have laid out how to use icon relationship roles may not be the best way, and that they are trusting the internet community to come up with a better way, if there is a better way.
I don't even say a better way. It's just like, I think, any RPG, and it doesn't matter if it's sci-fi, fantasy, and what system, there's always another way to interpret a rule or to use it. And I think that's how this is. You know, if you want to use it how the book talks about, that's great. There's lots of other ones.
I can't tell if that's lazy game design or brilliant game design. For just realizing, hey, this is a mechanic that we don't have time to go into, but we're trusting that the rest of the...
I'd lean towards brilliant. If they've, you know, obviously these guys have gamed more than once, so they realize there's always house rules and people have interpretations, so instead of making it a hard line in the sand that you will not cross, let's be a little ambiguous and you guys figure it out. It's your game.
Yeah.
Here's some guidelines and here's how we use it. That's why I like how they do that, how they use it in their own games. And you can go from there. I mean, I don't think anyone, it doesn't matter what system you're in, any system, no two GMs or groups run it the same. I think you've seen that enough on game days and conventions and just gaming over the years. As you get a new group together, the dynamics are different. So I think it's a good rule. I like the way they write it.
Well, and it's definitely a improvisational tool. But if you're a GM who isn't very good at improv, or a player who's not very good at improv, then you might not want to play it as it's written.
Yeah. And if you're a GM who's not good at improv, you should totally check out my series on my blog about how to improv. Thanks for that plug.
And if you're not comfortable improv, it just takes a little more homework on your part on figuring out what are the icons, how they interact, how the player's going to interact. And maybe that takes some pregame work before you actually start the game. Is okay, what character do you want? What's your relationship? You know, what kind of relationships? What's your unique thing? I tied mine in. And hopefully you noticed that.
Oh, yeah.
We just kind of finished up our 13th age. I ran a half-orc paladin, a positive relationship with the Crusader, because I was a paladin of the Crusader. And I had an ambiguous one with the Diabolist, because my unique thing, had some demon blood in me.
Yep.
And we used that in the game.
Well, that's
But you didn't have to. I could have picked the Elf Queen. Well, why? Well, maybe she's still sad or feels bad for the whole orc race thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's lots of different icons and how you can use them and interpret them, how they have a connection with your character.
Well, that's how one of the guys in our gaming group that wrapped up last night had a halfling bard who had a background that was an arcane thief, and when he was picking his relationship icons, he tied that in. He has a negative relationship with the Lich King because he stole something of magical value from him. So, yeah, the whole once you get into the game and at the table, all the different unique things that are a little bit more narrative really start coming together.
Yeah, and that might be a suggestion for GMs when people are creating their group and creating your character, and you say, "Oh, okay, I'm gonna have a positive relationship with the Elf Queen." You should ask why.
Mm-hmm.
Get those stories. Get the players to help build your stories in the campaign.
Dig a little
and
deeper.
And it helps. I've found it helps if instead of just and we've talked about that, it doesn't need to be the crunchiness. I think the game has enough of that. It's what story do you want your character to have in our campaign? And when it comes out in gameplay that, oh, yeah, you have that positive relationship with the Crusader, this is why this happened.
So I haven't played a lot of 13th Age lately. I start a campaign on Friday. I can see how using icon relationships on an overall campaign would add a lot to the storyline. How have you guys seen it play out in session to session? Because you're supposed to roll for new icon relationship or new dice rolls at each session.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would say like kind of the easiest way when you're starting off is kind of flavors the magic items that you hand out during the session. The Book of Loot is a kind of setup to help you with that if you decide to go that way, because all of the magic items are laid out as by icon. But you don't really want the players to equate rolling a six with getting a new magic item.
Well,
so,
and you end up running into issues if you carry too many magic items as well.
See, I don't see that being an issue. I love the way
as
quirks
a GM,
work.
Of course,
yeah,
you right,
yeah, quirks right. And all that, but.
Well, Mark, you've played...
I just think it's deeper than that. And just, yeah. Oh, you rolled a six, here's a +2 sword.
Exactly.
No, it should be... and I liked how we developed it. We changed as the campaign went on to where, like, last night, fighting some demons, some of the rolls didn't go too well. James kind of said, hey, you know, you had a six with the Crusader. How would you make this work? Because I rolled a 1 on one of my attacks. And I was like, you know what? I'm fighting demons. I'm a paladin. He helps guide my hand. How about a reroll? Nothing set, you know, the crunchy, okay, here's a +5 sword. No, it was, let me have another reroll. And sure enough, I rolled a 19, played right into it, kind of the gaming karma.
Oh, yeah?
And fighting the demons. And then, you know, with some of the conflicted ones, we had a little tension, and they were trying to get me to go with the demons because they were like, hey, you know what? We know you have demon blood. I can smell it. Come on. You don't really want to follow him. And it came out, you know, between my unique thing and the relationship dice and... I like that dangling carrot. Hey, you want this storyline? You want this conflicted or a negative one? Where maybe people, instead of just a dangling carrot, they're actually chasing you down.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, I'm guessing Luke had a negative.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So Lich King, I'm out to get you. I'm not going to help you. I'm going to try to make you fail at every opportunity.
Yeah.
Even if I don't like the other icon that maybe you're going against, for now, you're going down.
Exactly.
So have you used the story or the flavor text of explaining away the fives and sixes that you've rolled? Have you linked them together from session to session, or is it each session I come up with some new backstory on why this is happening?
Well, the way Jam ran it and I liked was instead of just, oh, okay, you rolled a six, so okay, get this. No, it was you convince me, how does this connect? Why should you get some sort of a bonus? One time we were trying to figure out a riddle, and we were all just totally lost. And it happens sometimes.
Yep.
Sometimes you have a group that's not that intelligent. And sometimes it's just a long day of work, and you're just kind of burnt. And you're like, I'm here. I like the game, but there's no brain power. I can't figure this puzzle out. And he's like, well, you know, you get your relationship dice. You're like, oh, that's right. Hey, wait a minute. You know, that time, you know, I rolled a 5 with the Elf Queen, and remember that time? And you tie it in as role-playing and your story, maybe your unique thing can tie into it. And instead of just, here's a bonus or, okay, here's a real, make it work. Get that player involvement. But it might be harder in convention settings where you have your one time and you've got it, you know, what's my background? But in a campaign, you can really develop your storyline and get the players involved. I think you get more satisfaction out of it.
Mark makes it sound like I have a lot more together. I didn't mean to make lazy sound earlier like something I look down upon, because I'm very much a lazy GM and I like pushing as much as I can back out to my players. And you guys ran with it. Like, yes, yeah. I would come into the session with some.
Yeah, if it's your improvisational style, yeah. too, of I'm okay, you can come up with whatever wacky stuff you want. I can roll with it.
Yeah.
Not that anything was too wacky. It's just get the player involvement instead mm-hmm. of just roll your dice. Oh, okay, you got a six. Okay, here's this magic item.
Yeah.
Or, oh, you rolled a six. Okay, you solved the puzzle. No, it helps. I feel more satisfaction when we actually solve the puzzle or make a lucky guess at that one. Thank you, Gareth, for that killer dwarf
statue puzzle
that would have killed us if we didn't just happen to guess right. But we kind of narrowed it down.
That's right. And sometimes I'll go in with a couple of story hooks or special effects, if you will, that'll hinge on somebody rolling a five or a six. But for the most part, I'll keep that down to maybe one or two that comes up while I'm thinking about the game. I am more satisfied at the end of the night as a DM if my players, like Mark, bringing in the demon blood, and it was a very epic time for him to call on the Crusader and cash in that six, if you will, for a reroll. I'm not saying it's always a reroll, but in that moment, it made sense.
Yeah, and we've used it before. Like I think it was one of the puzzles where somebody had rolled, and I forget it was a five or six, but it's okay, then that secret knowledge. Okay, well, while you were studying back under the priestess, you remember this little bit of lost knowledge. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, it happens on five and six the way that the rules are written. Assigning an effect to every die number. Kind of like that aspect where if no one rolls a five or six tonight, gee, nothing extra is going to happen. Or maybe if you assign every number means something.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like that, reading how they roll it.
Well, that's a good segue. So what are some – Nick, you did a little bit of research digging into other uses for icon relationships that the 13th Age fan community has pushed out. What did you find?
Well, I found one article that I thought summarizes kind of the way I look at things really well. Was on the Chamber of Mazarbul. And like Mark mentioned, we will be linking to all of these articles that we've used and maybe referencing for the listeners' enjoyment and reference. One of the things that he says is that he likes using the relationship dice as it's written because they are supposed to be an improvisational story tool and stories shouldn't be repetitious from session to session or predictable. So if you're just using your dice as a mechanic, so you're getting a magic item or you're getting a reroll or you're getting an answer to a riddle or something like that, and it's predictable in that way, then you're losing out on a lot of what the dice can actually bring to the table. And he also did comment that when you're working in a one-shot or at a convention or something like that, sometimes it's a little bit harder to pull some of that story into it.
It really is. I ran two sessions of Wrath of the Orc Lord at Gen Con, and it's kind of intimidating to go in there and be like, I don't know any of you. I don't know your play style.
Maturity level.
Some of you don't even
know the game.
Yeah, it was their first time playing. So I've got 2 hours a piece for each of these sessions. We're just going to cover what comes up, and you know, you try and throw, hey, this would be a good time for you to use, you know, this five or, you know, the six. It was interesting.
Well, one of the other ones that Mark mentioned was on the Vault of the 13th Age, and the title of your article is Whiffless Icon Rolls, and it talks about instead of just relying on the fives and sixes that come up, you assign some event to or some trigger to every single one of the numbers. Whether that's a support that, you know, you just get this freebie, or it's a favor with strings attached, or you get some information, but it may or may not be true, depending on your relationship, and you end up having to kind of role play that out. Trials, where you can get this bonus or you can get this advantage if you go do something else for that icon. So they're definitely strong strings attached. Conflict, where you're having to kind of take a choice between two sides and how that plays out. And then just a flat-out request that not you requesting something from an icon, but that an icon is in turn requesting something from you. And you have the option of either accepting their request for help or denying it or trying to talk your way out of it. I thought that was a really neat way of doing it. And one of the other things they talk about in this particular article was instead of rolling your dice at the beginning of each session, you roll your dice at the moment that you need help. Mm-hmm. So instead of, like I said, at the beginning or at the end of the session for the GM's benefit, if you're stuck at a puzzle, it's like, well, I'm going to go ahead. I have three dice for tonight. I'm going to go ahead and roll one of them and see what I get from this icon.
Mm-hmm.
And then play with it from that point.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. And I've read stuff where people suggest instead of the beginning, roll it at the end of the session for next session.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more of the planner type GM who needs to know what are the dice going to say. You know, and they should track, I think you did, who has relationships with which icons.
There's a great aid by Kazakami on the Pelgrain site that we'll link to for tracking your player, you know, what relationship dice, you know, your players have with who, what the relationship is, and what they've rolled for the evening. One of the other uses that they have in the main book that we didn't really touch on is the fact that you can spontaneously have your players mm-hmm. generate new results to see who's involved. If the players take the story in a way you hadn't planned, have them roll relationship dice, see what comes up.
Or if something monumental happens, you know, exactly. they finally slay the dragon at the top of the tower. Well, that's going to have an impact on the rest of the icons that are out there. Let's do another roll.
Exactly.
Yep.
So yeah,
and for those
limited.
Who are shying away from the whole, well, do they have a relationship with the icon? Well, it doesn't mean you're talking to the Elf Queen, but you're talking to that faction, as they talk about in Chapter 2, page 38. People in the Icons organizations know about you. That's, you know, when you're doing these roles, and I think you talked about an aid where you can track, you know, every session, you know, Mark's rolling a six with the Crusader. People are going to start noticing in that organization.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about utility and usefulness, but I think one way to use it is if you keep rolling a lot of positives, they start noticing, hey, this guy's an up-and-comer. It's one way to help track,
mm-hmm.
you know, as you're doing stuff, not just going up in level, but you can help track, hey, this guy's a lot of successes for that icon or against that icon. So
that actually reminds me of a blog post that you wrote, JM, about using factions as icon relationships. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, actually, I'm gearing up for a Planescape 13th Age game. And for those of you who may or may not be aware, one of the big story components of Planescape is the factions that are vying for control of Sigil. And the kind of a very easy way, if you're looking at it, to just drop your icons in there, just pick the 15 factions or some number of them that you want to support and slap the name icon on them and let players get their relationship dice with them. So I'm going to be tracking the icon relationship rolls across the whole of the campaign. Every 5 and 6 with a faction is going to amount to 1 status point with that faction. As players accumulate more and more faction points, there will be different tiers in the actual faction that will unlock for them. The example that comes to mind is in second edition D&D, where Planescape came from, every faction right off the bat, just by joining it, you gained a special ability. And then they had a small little section like, here are some other benefits of being part of a faction. Aid, magic items, information, quests, all of this stuff that kind of makes sense for being part of a group. Some of the items or some of the abilities were really cool, like being part of the Dustman faction. Undead didn't attack them. The whole campaign you played, if you were a Dustman, if you went into a fight, undead wouldn't attack you unless you attacked them first. They'd slaughter the rest of the party, but you would be okay. So that's a faction ability that I want to have them unlock. And I'm toying around. Oh,
what faction special ability do the Modrons give you?
Oh, the Modrons were not a faction, but they would probably give you... I think Modrons in second edition, one of their special abilities was you roll initiative at the start of the campaign, and that's your initiative for the campaign.
Hmm.
Your GM may be nice and let you re-roll each level, but they're very ordered and lawful, and so you only get to roll initiative once, and that's the number you always go on, you know, whether you rolled a 19 or whether you rolled a 6. But I don't know. If I did, I'll have to think about that. If I had Primus as a... as a faction or as an icon, what would I give them?
The calculus feat.
That's right. You can do math in your head.
So what would you do if you're accumulating points for special things is if you have a negative relationship and you accumulate?
See, that's one of the things I'm toying with. I'm thinking that every
more
player...
hatred?
What?
More hatred?
More hatred. Negative icon relationships in the game don't necessarily mean that you are directly interacting always with the object of your hatred, if that makes sense, your negative relationship. So if Nick's got a negative relationship with the Lich King, sixes on the roll, maybe aid from other factions who are aligned against the Lich King. So if you have a negative relationship, say, with the Doomguard, their enemies are the Fraternity of Order and the Harmonium. So sixes with negative relationship with the Doomguard could be either opportunities to strike at the Doomguard or support from the Fraternity of Order or the Harmonium, because you know, they're enemies of the Doomguard and they want to do anything they can to kind of help. The other thing I'm pondering doing with this mechanic is counting fives as false inflation, a puffed up reputation. And if the group suffers a campaign loss, all of their fives in their faction status go away. The powers that be realize exactly where you stand with them, and it's not nearly as high as you thought it was. Or maybe just making that one possible consequence of a campaign loss. One of the gentlemen who posted on the article was wondering if the five was too heavy of a blow, because you know if you only have one or two dice in a relationship, how often are you getting fives or sixes? And the answer is, if you're playing a Paladin or Crusader, quite a bit, because
you have to take the
Way of Evil Bastards.
I get to re-roll ambiguous. Or
relationships with ambiguous icons.
Yeah, ambiguous icons or evil. So I got quite a few because I re-rolled.
It's an advantage of being a paladin.
I took the feat, pay the price.
Well, one of the things that I've seen pop up again and again as I was searching the internets is using or handing out chips or some sort of tokens for fives and sixes, and then allowing the players to turn in those tokens as a way of being able to use a reroll, or hey, I rolled really badly on this skill check. Here's one of my chips and let me pass, or you know, let me reroll or something like that. And like I said, I've seen that come up again and again.
Accumulate though. So if I rolled and say I got three chips tonight, but I didn't use any, next session I get those three plus any new rolls?
I've seen it go both ways. Yeah.
So basically every five and six goes into a pool and they're no longer necessarily related to the icon?
Correct. Yeah. And that's where I think a lot of people are trying to make a mechanic, something crunchy out of this non-crunchy rule.
Okay, listen up, people. It's not a crunchy game.
It's like a Milky Way bar. It's crunchy where it needs to be and delicious everywhere else.
I think that because this is such a unique thing to the gaming world, I mean, I'm not aware of any other gaming system that has something like these icon relationship roles.
No, I've been playing for a long time, and when I first got the book, or you know, we started playing and Jam shared, and I'm starting reading, I was like, wow, this is nothing like I've ever experienced. Yeah. And the whole, it's not just, like before, okay, I follow, you know, the God of Good, whatever. No, this is all kinds of conflicted, or they're good, they're bad, they're meh, they're neutral. It's just there's so many ways, so many permutations to do this and to work with it. I thought it was great.
Right, and I think that's what people are struggling with, though, is because in all the other systems, there's a crunch to every rule. There's some way of, you know, if you dissect this sentence enough, you can figure out exactly how I can use this to my advantage. And these icon relationship roles aren't like that at all. It's supposed to be.
And I think even story. As you develop it, yeah, it's the story, but also, and I kind of made a note too, is that, you know, we talked about, you know, player based or GM based, as far as does the GM interpret it or does the player use it? And there's nothing wrong with going both ways.
You know,
if you have an idea and you use up my six before you offer it to me, or we use it somehow where, hey, I think, hey, I can use that six, so be it. You know, I mean, and I think people are going to have to play with it. Yeah, people have to play with it and see how they like to use it, how they don't like to use it. They might try those fate point chips, tokens, and if they like that way to go with it, that's fine. You know, don't be afraid to change it or say, hey, let's try this for a couple sessions. What do you think? I think that's how we started. Hey, let's try it like this, and we were fine with it, you know. But
I think between icon relationships, backgrounds, and one unique things, and I think we're probably going to do a show on each of those three mechanics, like an in-depth show. They are a new way of looking at what GMs were kind of always doing, but never had it codified. I think a lot of people were using icon relationships more from a narrative perspective, like if you're playing the Forgotten Realms and you know, okay, Dritz is showing up, or the Red Wizards of Fae are the main bad guy of the campaign. How are you tied into this? I think by giving a little framework to it, it helps bring it to the forefront of something that I think a lot of GMs were, again, just doing kind of behind the scenes without a mechanic, if you will, to fall back on.
Yeah. It's almost, I'm kind of just popped into my head, it's almost like a fudge mechanic.
Yeah.
DMs have been fudging stuff for years. If you had never heard about that as a player, then
what?
Well, I'm sorry. But yeah, it happens sometimes. Sometimes you're just killing the party and it's no fault of their own. They're just rolling horrible and you're rolling crits every other roll. Sometimes you got to fudge it unless you want to TPK just because,
yeah.
You know, sometimes it's not fun. If they stumble into it and they're just hard-headed, hey, that's just the way it goes. I've done that to a group that just didn't understand you can run away and they won't chase you that far. But yeah, it's almost like a rule for, almost like for fudging. Like, cause in first edition, you run into Tomb of Horrors type stuff where you're just, you're dying. Like, I just don't understand what I have to do because we're going to die.
Well,
and you kind of dangle something out there to give them a way out or help them.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost how you can interpret it.
There is a fine balancing point for puzzles and such. And at one point of the scale, it's fun because the players are engaged in trying to figure it out. And there is a point as a GM where I can go, okay, no one's having fun anymore because it's now been 15 minutes and they're still stuffing.
Oh, 15 minutes is nothing. Try going for like an hour where people are just obsessing over something that you just, all right, here's the answer. Let's move on.
That's right. Give me a
wisdom check.
It's
not going to kill anyone. It's not the end of the story. Yeah, it's.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's nice to be able to, as the GM, have something to fall back on that the players can go, oh yeah, he's not just making this up. I do have a relationship with this person, and the Archmage does keep hippogriffs as pets, so I would know the answer to this puzzle that has hippogriffs in it,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Or like last night we were fighting, I forget her name, the type of demon.
Oh, she was a Dybbuk.
Dybbuk, yeah. And because of my relationship, the hint was there that, you know, the longer she stays in this plane, the weaker she's going to get.
Hmm.
What I didn't figure out was the escalation dies. It went up. She got weaker because we kept getting the, well, you can have this happen, but the escalation die is going to go down one. And, of course, since we're getting beat on, we were like, yeah, we'll take it. Move it down, move it down. Didn't realize he was going, I have three more rounds now to beat on you.
That's right.
When it hit six, he was gone. That's we didn't realize that.
Stay tuned for the episode on wicked uses of the escalation die.
No, it was good. It was good. Yeah. And I like that. That's a whole other rule I like. Because it's not just your, you know, your plus one hit, your plus two hit. There's a lot of, when you redo the classes, there's a lot of things that trigger off of that. Not to go off on a tangent on escalation dice.
I think it ties back to Rob and Jonathan's design of the game. They brought some really neat, interesting mechanics that play well right out of, you know, rules as written. They play well raw. But there's so much more you could be doing with it. Like, for example, in Eyes of the Stone Thief, Gareth talks about using the escalation die as a timer. And that's just the next iteration of how we can tweak this mechanic even further. Like most genius ideas, when you look at it, you're kind of like, oh, well, that's so simple. Why didn't I think of it? And then it starts a whole new train of thinking along that line.
Yeah. And there's other, if you start digging into some of the classes, I kind of made a note, like the Sorcerer and his blood link to the icons.
Yeah,
I could see all kinds of ways to take those relationship dice. Because if you're developing a sorcerer and you take, you know, the blood link to the Elf Queen, hopefully one of your icon relationships are going to be with the Elf Queen so we can help tweak it. You don't have to. Nothing in the rules say you have to. You can pick two completely different ones. I think it would help, though, to have at least one of those attached to her. And I kind of like the opposite, her and then whoever her enemy is, instead of just two. Like, I could have taken the Crusader and
the Emperor.
The Emperor.
Yeah.
And didn't have enough conflict for me. Yeah. It's like, no, I'm going to take the Diabolist.
Yeah, Mark brings up a really good point. If you like icons and icon relationship roles, there are some classes that really play off of this. The Chaos Mage, the Sorcerer. Mm-hmm. The Bard is very heavily into icon dice manipulation, not just icon manipulation. And then, as Mark said, you know, the Way of Evil Bastards for the Paladin really lets you get the extra mileage out of your ambiguous icon relationships.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, nothing like rolling, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then turn it into a couple of fives and a six. You're like, woot!
Yeah. It was lots to play with last night in the game. So,
yep.
Well, any final thoughts, guys?
I have two final thoughts. One, I guess to summarize kind of the way I look at how icon relationship roles are supposed to be used and how they should be used is I think they're supposed to be a catalyst for your imagination, where they inspire you to come up with some part of the story, to engage you a bit more into, rather than the, I have a sword, so I'm going to swing it, to saying, well, I am, you know, a half-orc paladin who is aligned with the Crusader, and because of that relationship, I'm not just going to swing the sword, I'm going to swing it super hard because this guy's the foe of the Crusader. Mm-hmm. And just really supposed to, you know, get you into that game a little bit more. And the more engaged you are as a player, the more fun you're going to have, the more fun everyone is going to have, and the more memorable a story you're going to walk away with. And I think that's the goal of every game session, is to walk away with a good story.
And lots of loot.
And lots of loot. That's right.
The other thing I was just going to mention was if you need a little bit more crunch to it, if you want some more specific examples of, in this situation, how could I use a five or a six? The knighterrantjr.blogspot.com has three really good articles that gives a number of examples of, in this situation, like when your character dies or you have a TPK or you rescue someone who you didn't have to rescue, give some really good examples on how to use those fives and those sixes in a way that furthers the story. And we will link those in the show notes. But yeah. I just want to make a call out to them because I thought those articles were really well written and really good ideas.
And very I cool. think if any listeners have a completely different way, then please share.
Yeah.
Like, gaming community is always looking. There's reasons that all these blogs and Pelgrin's good at linking anything to do with 13th Age. Just throw it out there. Share it.
Yeah, hit the Google Plus community or send it into the show and we'll link it and put it up for you. So,
and give you credit.
That's right. And give you credit. We will not take credit for it. Unless it's a really, really good idea. And then, who are you? Look at this piece of paper we found in our inbox. So, we are pleased to announce our first contest for the Iconic Podcast. As you know, the White Dragon is our mascot, and so we're asking you, our listeners, to submit the answer to the following question. Who was the White Dragon, and why did the Wizard King kill him?
When you submit your entries, the things that we are looking for are creativity and entertainment. We will look at all of the submissions and evaluate them, and whichever one we like best or think that we could spend the best campaign off of, we will choose that as the winner. So, Wade, why don't you go ahead and tell us what the winners get?
Well, what could be better than a Pelgrane store voucher in a beautiful PDF format? So we'll be giving away three Pelgrane store vouchers, good for purchase of any product on the Pelgrane Press shop online, in the amounts of $20 for the grand prize, $10, and $5.
This contest ends October 31st, so make sure we have your email submissions to whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com before then.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.